It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Fridays, we like to have quick conversations. We've got about a half dozen topics to cover this hour. Some of the news that we didn't get to otherwise during our talk shows this week. A little later in the hour, an opinion, very interesting opinion that was in the New York Times today, penned by a man from Marion County here in Iowa, talking about why rural Iowa voted for Donald Trump. That coming up yet this half hour. Well, already the sixth day of the new year. Hope you're easing your way into 2017 in fine fashion, staying warm above all. And while the majority of Iowa's new laws take effect in July, when we have new laws, right, January marks the beginning of a few key changes for our economy this year, an increase in the minimum wage for some people in Iowa, in certain counties, Linn and Wapello counties. Also, a sales tax. Did you notice that? Amazon addicts. A sales tax now applied to purchases for Iowa customers. To help us understand the effects of these moves, Dave Swenson is with us, professor of economics at Iowa State University. Hi again, Dave.
Hello.
Well, those of us who like to order online from Amazon for the first time as of January 1st, now sales tax collected from Iowa customers. Last month, I understand the company announced it would be required to collect Iowa's 6% sales tax beginning just a few days ago. What prompted this?
Well, nobody really knows. Amazon announced this on their own. State Department of Revenue and Finance officials haven't been able to find out why Amazon did it. But I doubt that Amazon is being altruistic. So there must be some reason behind it. It's just that we don't know what it is. One theory, and I'm just pulling this out of the air, is that Amazon fulfills a lot of their orders using partners, not just Amazon warehouses. It could be, and I'm just guessing here, it could be that some of those partner fulfillment retailers or wholesalers might be located in Iowa. And so that's just my best guess, and I'm just making that up.
Mm-hmm. Iowa joins the majority of other states, right, that Amazon does business with?
That's exactly right.
I think some 30 other states already charge sales tax. So how much revenue does this mean for the state? Or you could put it another way, how much revenue has Iowa lost out on in the past years?
Well, we don't know because Amazon is the most notable of the online retailers that doesn't have a physical presence here in Iowa, but there's Amazon, Overstock.com, CVC, Zappos, Roadrunners. There's any number of them that really don't typically have presences. What I do know, though, is Amazon dwarfs all of the other online retailers. I'm using May 2016 numbers, but they had over $83 billion in sales the previous year, which was more than the next 12 online retailers behind them. Mm-hmm. So they're the majority of it. So how much does it make for state government? The Department of Revenue and Finance said it could be anywhere between 18 and 24 million. That's with all online retailing. Let's assume that Amazon accounts for 60, 65%, two-thirds of that. What does it mean in terms of revenues for Iowa? Maybe a boost of $12 to $15 million in revenues. That's less than a half a percent of the actual sales tax collections that we collect annually. But nonetheless, in a year in which there's been an announced $100 million shortfall in the current budget year, this is welcome news, I think, to state officials.
Right, and welcome news to the brick-and-mortar businesses in Iowa. It's been a thorn in their side, hasn't it? Because
it has.
It's a matter of fairness.
More than a matter of fairness. It's not just a matter of fairness. That's one thing. But Amazon has expanded so rapidly, it has eroded the viability of a lot of Main Street. Let me give you a figure here. If I just exclude gasoline and automobiles, things that you and I don't buy online, back in 2000, electronic and mail order sales, that's how commerce defines them, were 5.5% of total retail sales. By the third quarter of 2016, it had grown to 14.3%. The industry is growing at somewhere between 10 and 14% per year, whereas all other retail activity is only growing by about 3% to 4% per year.
So that gives you an idea of how much of a difference this can make. Quickly, before we go, Dave, let's talk about the thousands of Iowans starting out the new year with a raise, a minimum wage up in some counties in Iowa.
Yes, it is. It's up in a handful of counties. Yes, Johnson for one, and other counties that had enacted a new minimum wage. So it is going to make a difference. Remember, and we need to put this in perspective, the minimum wage is important to a fraction of the workforce, but the number of workers making the minimum wage isn't that large. And so it's an important part of the economy, but it doesn't move the economy plus or minus that much. What it does do, though, is make those recipients of the increase better off.
Lynn County up to 825. I think that's the first phase. Johnson County in a third phase, I think, of their raise. Polk County seeing a raise in the minimum wage to $8.75 per hour. So, you know, kind of curious. We just have individual counties doing it. The legislative action this session, can they stop the counties from doing this? Will they have a statewide minimum wage?
Well, that's a great question. Currently, no, they can't stop it, but Iowa is the kind of state where we don't have very strong home rule, and if the state wants to step on local government initiatives, it can very easily with legislative action. The governor has promised wants to push for a statewide minimum wage. The implication there is to limit local government action, and as of last count, he indicated that he wanted an increase in the minimum wage. How that shakes it out in the next legislative session, we'll just have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Does that make a difference to how people do business or where people live in the state when we have these sort of differences in minimum wage?
On the margins, not a lot. It doesn't make people move to or away from specific areas en masse. It may make minor differences for some people. What it does, though, do is it makes working in Johnson County or working in Lynn County or working in Polk County, if you're in one of the surrounding counties, a little bit more desirable because it offsets the driving costs and it makes those places more desirable to work.
Okay, Dave Swenson, thanks for stepping into our studio. Professor of Economics at Iowa State University.
Thank you.
Until next time, Dave. Thanks.
You bet.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Monday on this program, during this noon hour, I'll be joined by Iowa Public Radio's legislative correspondent, Joyce Russell. We'll be talking on Monday with legislative leaders from both parties about some of the key issues likely to be addressed in the news session. The news session starting next week. Joining us now, though, to survey the new Iowa political landscape. It is very new. One of our ever so able regular political analysts, Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben.
Trifecta. That is the word I've been hearing in the news a lot. You and me both, all of us. For the first time in nearly 20 years, Iowa Republicans control the House, the Senate, the governor's office. In broad terms, what are the new dynamics? What's that likely to mean?
Well, it means that the Republicans, the agenda that had been stopped in the Iowa Senate when the Senate Democrats were in control, whatever agenda comes out of the Iowa House now has a better chance of certainly making it through the Iowa Senate and then presumably a better chance of being signed by the governor. So, you know, having unified Republican control means that the Republicans can push their agenda more aggressively, presumably, but it also means that, you know, if things don't get done or if legislation is passed that is out of step with public opinion in the state, that all the blame then goes back on the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. What issues are you looking at that are likely to have highest priority for the Republicans?
Well, I think, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about collective bargaining rights in Iowa.
Weakening them.
Yes, weakening collective bargaining rights. There's been talk about social issue legislation. There's been speculation just certainly in terms of the budget overall, in terms of how much is going to be spent, spending on, you know, education funding, whether it's K-12 or higher education funding, tax cuts. So there are a lot of issues that are coming together that there's just a lot of speculation about because the Republicans have not been in control, as you said, for a number of years. And now that they have that control, you know, everybody's kind of waiting to see what is going to happen. And in Iowa, we have to also remember with the legislative session that things actually move quite quickly, you know, because we have those funnel weeks spaced out throughout the session where if legislation doesn't get through a committee or doesn't get into the other chamber, then that legislation, unless it's an appropriations bill, is essentially dead. So, you know, they're going to have to move quickly on whatever that agenda is going to be.
Sometimes when you have unified government, you can say hurrah, but then all of a sudden the factions within your party surface make themselves felt. Is that likely to be the case, do you think, in the Iowa legislature?
Yeah, there's a chance for that. I think, you know, when you look at research on governors, actually what you find is that governors in a lot of cases actually prefer divided control, because those factions then are battling out within their own chamber, but then there's a check with the other chamber. So as, you know, as the chief executive, there is some benefit to having divided government, because those factions, the legislation that those factions are pushing usually doesn't end up on your desk. Now, you know, we still may see some in-party fighting within the Iowa House, within the Iowa Senate, but now there's probably a higher likelihood that whatever those factions are pushing will end up getting to the governor's desk.
Mm-hmm. So the Democrats in this position, do they sit back with folded arms and weep with their reduced status? What can they do?
Well, they can continue to fight. You know, I think we're going to see certainly some disagreements on the overall spending levels. You know, there are going to be disagreements on education. There's going to be disagreements when it comes to tax cuts. So there is going to be an aggressive push by the Democrats. They're not just going to sit back. Similar to when Republicans were the minority in the Iowa Senate, there was a lot of pushback on different pieces of legislation that were coming through or that were coming out of the Iowa House. So there's still going to be a lot of fighting. And then, you know, once we get through this session, you're going to start talking about the gubernatorial race. That's very different than what we've had in the past. And so, you know, that fighting is still going to be there. It's just that Republicans now have control. But in terms of what they do with it, there is still the potential for public backlash, because if you don't get done what you say you're going to do, the public will, excuse me, direct their blame toward the chief executive. And in this case, you know, that will be toward a Republican governor.
Mm-hmm. Let's pick up on the leap to 2018. The governorship mm-hmm. will be on the ballot in that election. Likely that Kim Reynolds, who will assume the governorship here shortly, we don't know quite when, will be on the ballot, giving the GOP an advantage of incumbency, I imagine.
Yeah, it will. And, you know, again, this is one of those shocks to the system, I think, for Iowa politics, that, like what we saw with Tom Harkin. You know, in Iowa, we've become accustomed to incumbents serving for long periods of time. And then when they retire or take another position, as Governor Branstad does, it causes all this reshuffling. And so I think everybody's trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen in 2018. Yes, Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds will be the incumbent, assuming she takes over, you know, midway through the 2017 session. And she will have the advantage there. But it's been a long time since we've had this sort of transition of power in the chief executive office, right? We had Governor Ray for 14 years, Branstad for 16 years, and then Tom Vilsack for 8 years. All three of them voluntarily retired or, you know, took other positions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Chuck Culver defeated. We haven't had this sort of midterm transition in, you know, I'm not even sure when you'd have to go back quite a ways to do that, to look at that. And then there's going to be presumably some jockeying for position within the Republican Party. It looks like Kim Reynolds will probably not face any competition for that primary in 2018, so she will be the incumbent.
Though the Republican mayor of Cedar Rapids, Ron Corbett, announced he's not running for re-election. That may be some competition.
He may be. And I think what he's probably doing is looking what's going to happen in the 2017 session and then the 2018 session. Because for Kim Reynolds, you know, for her challenge is what legislative agenda does she run on? What set of accomplishments does she run on in 2018? In 2017, you know, it's going to be midway through the session before she officially assumes the office of governor. So then she'll just have the 2018 session, and that's going to be an election year session where we know sometimes you don't see a lot of big changes because it is an election year. Legislators want to get out of there early so they can go back home to their districts and campaign. So she will have, you know, basically 1.5 sessions where she is officially the governor. And so she's going to be running on a lot of the accomplishments over the last 8 years, really, of the Branstad-Reynolds ticket.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things quickly before we have to go. On the Democratic side, we heard former DNR Director Rich Leopold announcing his intentions to run for the Democratic nomination for governor, right?
That's right. And in the challenge there for Rich Leopold and any Democrat is really generating statewide enthusiasm. The last few midterm election cycles, if you look at 2010, in 2014, have not gone well for the Democrats. We've seen, you know, big drops in turnout in Iowa statewide compared to a general election in the midterm election. And so for the Democratic Party, their challenge is to generate enthusiasm for whatever candidate is out there, because they will be going up against an incumbent governor. And we know that incumbent governors in Iowa tend to fare pretty well. I mean, Chet Culver, with the exception in 2010, incumbent governors have won re-election going all the way back to 1963. So, you know, being an incumbent in Iowa means a lot, and there's a lot of power attached to that. So for the Democrats, the challenge is getting enthusiasm and getting people fired up about a midterm election when typically turnout does not work in their favor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks for your survey of the new Iowa political landscape. A reminder again that we'll be having Governor Branstad's condition of the state broadcast live here on Tuesday morning. Chris, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you, Ben.
Finally, this half hour, let me read you an excerpt from an opinion piece written by a native Iowan, a reporter in rural Marion County, published this week in the New York Times. See if it resonates with you. I have struggled to understand how these conservative friends and neighbors I respect and at times admire can think so differently from me, not to mention how over 60% of voters in my county could have chosen Mr. Trump. Words written by Bob Leonard, special news editor for KNIA, KRLS, Knoxville, Pella, the author of an op-ed in the New York Times this week titled Why Rural America Voted for Trump. He joins me by phone. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We've got about 5 minutes. Your goal was to address that question. Also, it's important to mention, as someone, you grew up in a fairly liberal household, you say in the piece, that voted mostly Democratic. How did you go about answering this?
Well, yeah, I grew up in a liberal household. My grandpa Leonard believed Franklin Delano Roosevelt saved his family with 11 kids from starving. So it's just really, you know, in our bones. And so I just looked and talked with my friends, but really had an epiphany when J.C. Watts, former congressman from Oklahoma, football star, you know, really interesting fellow Baptist minister, came and laid out. He came to Pella for an event campaigning for Rand Paul, and he laid out something that he said was the difference between Republicans and Democrats. And when he was talking about a shooting in Lafayette, Louisiana, and as part of that, he said that Republicans know that the guy that did the shooting is a bad man. He's at fault. Where Democrats and liberals would say, well, you know, really, we're all sort of born good, and it must be society or the gun or something, you know, in economic inequality, whatever, that's to lay to the blame. That's what has to be blamed. And so Democrats want rules and regulations to restrict all of this stuff or fix things, where Republicans know where the blame lies,
uh-huh.
And it's in the person. And he says that relates to beliefs in God and relates back to original sin, that Republicans, at least from his perspective, believe that people are born bad and become good, you know, through being born again and through pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, where Democrats believe that we're born good and therefore when things happen bad, something else must be the problem.
You also mentioned in your piece how this ties into, well, we always talk about red states and blue states, right? And Iowa, well, I guess we're red now. We used to be purple. What is your thinking there?
Well, I think that, you know, there's something to that, especially when the Electoral College is involved. But I think it's really a red county versus blue county thing. If you look at the riverways, you know, the history, the geography, all of our blue counties across the nation, well, except in New Mexico, essentially, are along our major rivers, and our red counties are the hinterlands. And so I just contrast it. I think that it's red county versus blue county, mm-hmm. much mm-hmm. as anything else.
Let me read a little bit, an excerpt from your piece in the New York Times this week. Some of what liberals worry about, they see as pure nonsense, speaking about the conservatives, I guess. When you are the son or daughter of a carpenter or a mechanic, a housewife or a secretary who lives paycheck to paycheck, you can't afford to send kids to college. As many rural residents are, white privilege is meaningless and abstract. I didn't read that well, but your point is that white privilege among urban dwellers doesn't really resonate necessarily in their rural areas.
Well, I don't think it does. I mean, we've got a lot. I mean, there are racists and bigots and sexists and whatever everywhere, but I will not accept for a minute that there are any more in rural America than there are in urban America. I mean, you know, maybe somebody, a sociologist can prove me wrong, but that's not what I've seen from living in big cities and in smaller towns. And we have a lot of people that have worked their entire lives hard, have been given nothing, and have no privilege. And when the Eastern elite liberals are talking about the white privilege that we've been handed to them, to us, it's hard. Well, it's abstract. They've treated everybody they've ever met with dignity and have fought for everything they've got. And so they don't see where the white privilege, mm-hmm. you know, relates to them in their daily life. And they also get told that it's important by the liberals, that it's important for minorities to celebrate their cultures, but for white people to be ashamed of theirs. Mm. And it's not an easy burden to bear, that shame and white privilege, when you're working your tail off hoping that someday your kid can go to school.
Mm-hmm. What kind of reaction, Bob, have you gotten to this op-ed in the New York Times?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, it's been a lot of fun. Of course, there are people that think I'm an idiot, but that's, you know, that's going to happen. But it's been very positive. I've had, you know, queries from national television shows wanting me to come on, and when, you know, one of our most conservative panelists on a national program, one of our most liberal panelists on a national program, when their staff tells me they both loved it, I think I must have hit a nerve. But it's been fun, and it's an honor to be in the Times.
Very quickly before we go, also in the piece you say why many blame poor decisions by Mrs. Clinton for her loss in an environment like this, the Democratic candidate probably didn't matter.
It could have been anybody.
You think?
You know, absolutely. You know, some people like to say Bernie Sanders would have beat Trump in Iowa. You know, maybe they're right. I don't think so. They would have vilified Sanders as a socialist. I don't think it mattered. It could have been Martin O'Malley. I don't think it mattered. Everybody loves to blame Mrs. Clinton. And sure, she made mistakes. She made the mistakes any politician makes. But I don't think it mattered. I think the Republican brand is strong. It's very, very strong in Iowa. And, you know, and I think it's going to hold for a while. Something, the Democratic Party is going to have to do something, well, not just Iowa, nationally, to make improvements in the hinterlands.
Okay, Bob Leonard, thank you for joining us, reporter in rural Marion County, and also author of an op-ed piece in the New York Times this week titled Why Rural America Voted for Trump. Bob Leonard, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll look at why there's been a spike in fatalities from crashes on Iowa's roadways last year. Really big spike. We'll talk about that, and then we'll ask why more people are moving out of the state than moving in. Also, a new February music festival nestled in the historic village of East Davenport. That's all to come. Still on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio, I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay buckled up. We'll be right back with more of your Friday News Buzz. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last year was a deadlier year than most on Iowa's roadways. At least 400 people died in car crashes. That's an increase of more than 25% from the previous year, 2015. Now, road fatalities haven't been that high since 2008. The 2016 spike comes just 3 years after Iowa saw only, and I say only, 317 fatal car crashes. That's the lowest it's been in 70 years. Here to help us understand what might be behind last year's uptick and what can be done to curb traffic deaths, Patrick Hoy, the governor's Traffic Safety Bureau chief. Patrick Hoy, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Ben. Appreciate you having me on.
So tell us, what do you think is behind the increase in fatalities? A dramatic 25%, more than 25% increase.
Yeah, it really was a horrific year last year. When you take a look at the trend that we had been seeing since 2013, we certainly thought Iowa was trending down the right way, and then 2016 comes along, and we see some of the highest numbers since 2008. So, you know, one of the things that we'll be doing as a state and as a bureau is kind of taking a recap of 2016 and, you know, some of the early things that we're seeing. Once again, unbuckled fatalities is going to be over 40%. And, you know, when you think of a state that has a seatbelt compliance of around 94%, and yet 40% of our fatalities are unbuckled, you know, it really drives home the point of how important a seatbelt is. And then,
Isn't it also that seatbelts, you're seeing that people who are in the back seat may think they don't need a seatbelt?
Yeah, and you know, and that's really going to be one of the things that I think we need to focus on, and that's the public awareness campaign. And although it's not a law requirement, it does just make good sense. And you know, we've done some early polling, and when you talk to people about why they don't buckle up in the back seat, and you know, most of them aren't opposed to it. It's just it's a cultural thing. You know, we've never had to do it, so you really don't think about it when you get in the back seat. And so that'll be certainly one of the things that we'll be trying to step up the education campaign on in 2017.
Mm-hmm. What other causes do you see for this rise in fatalities?
You know, the impaired driving portion of the fatalities in the state of Iowa has really plateaued. Even when we look back to 13 and 14, 15, when we saw the trends coming down, impaired driving stayed the same. We're still at about approximately 30% of Iowa fatalities are impaired driving. And so, you know, that's certainly an area that I think we need to focus on. And, you know, not only is that an awareness campaign, but law enforcement working with that area. And then I would be pretty sure that the legislature this year will take a look at avenues to address impaired driving, too.
Okay, so we're talking about alcohol, other substances that make you perform less well behind the wheel.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was last summer that Governor Branstad called for a task force to study ways to decrease unsafe driving. What do we have from that task force so far?
You know, I'm part of that task force that has been taking a look at really a whole realm of topics. And, you know, one of the things that we've been looking at is everything from the graduated driver's license to obviously texting and driving, all seatbelt use in a car. There is a kind of an A to Z traffic safety program or results that will be released. And the Impaired Driving Coalition that met in February and has been working, taking a look at causations and recommendations for reducing that. I think a lot of those topics will probably get a strong look at during this next legislative session. And for department heads of state agencies that oversee, whether it be ignition and interlock devices from the Department of Transportation or from public health, I think a lot of the directors will be taking a look at some of these recommendations and seeing as their agency oversees some of those procedures, should they be changed? And if so, what implementation of new concepts should be done?
Mm-hmm. What about our young drivers, our drivers who've been on the road perhaps just a few months or just a few years? Do you see any possibilities there for improving? I know Iowa in recent years has implemented graduated driver's licenses, for instance.
Yeah, I think, you know, there certainly is an avenue when you're talking, you know, deaths for teenagers. Unfortunately, motor vehicle crashes is one of the leading causes of death for teenagers. So, you know, it certainly is something that needs to be looked at. And when we take a look at even the curriculum for driver's education, you know, has the time come to have a more defined curriculum? When we take a look at the graduated driver's license, you know, are the hours that are required to get your intermediate driver's license, are those hours sufficient? I think those are some of the things that we really probably should be taking a look at. And if when you have a year like we had last year with 400 fatalities, I think that it causes you as a state and as agencies to reflect on, you know what, we probably have to review what we're doing and make changes. We certainly can't have another year, or we certainly don't want to see another year of 400. So there has to be changes implemented to once again turn that trend in the right direction.
Patrick, tell us, what are your expectations for the legislature in this new session?
Well, I think there's going to be certainly some scrutiny of what we're currently doing in the state of Iowa, and I'm for sure that they'll be taking a look at distracted driving bills. I know the Department of Public Safety will be introducing a bill to cover distracted driving. I think programs like 24/7 for the impaired driving will get serious consideration from the legislature. So I think traffic safety will certainly be one of the serious topics that are covered in this 2017 legislative session.
Would you be surprised if some laws, more stringent laws, weren't passed?
I would be. I think that the time is probably right. You know, when you're looking at a year of 400 fatalities, I think that there will certainly be those discussions. And yeah, I do. I'm not sure which specific laws will make its way through, but I'd be surprised if we saw no traffic safety laws that came out of this session.
Okay, here's to a much safer 2017 on Iowa's roadways. Thank you very much, Patrick Hoy, the governor's Traffic Safety Bureau Chief. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. More people moved out of our state, out of Iowa last year, than moved in. That's according to a study by Atlas Van Lines. Now, Atlas has been following what it calls interstate migration patterns of its customers since the early 1990s, and Atlas says, in 2016, nearly 57% of all moves were for people leaving the state. Joining me now to discuss migration patterns of people in Iowa and in the U.S., Liesl Ethington, assistant scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Liesl.
Hello.
So how does this statistic from last year figure from Atlas Van Lines figure into the larger context over recent years of people moving in and out of Iowa?
The results from the Atlas study are pretty consistent with Census Bureau results, which is really what I prefer to look at. The studies like the Atlas study are great for drawing attention to certain issues, but since it's not really representative, we like to look at more reliable data like Census Bureau, but in this case, they tell the same story. Over the past 2 years, actually, Iowa has slipped back into looking like a net loser in terms of domestic migration flows.
Mm-hmm. So how do you explain that? What are the factors explaining more people? There are, just to be clear, we've got to picture our state, people moving out all the time, people moving in all the time, but in the last 2 years, you're saying more people have been exiting than entering.
Right. And it's good to get a little bit of perspective on it. When we're talking about the numbers here, it's not huge negatives or huge positives in any given year. Iowa tends to flirt with that break-even state. And so some years were slightly positive, some years were slightly negative. It just happened that in the past two, we're moving back more into that negative territory. But the magnitude isn't anything really alarming. It's pretty much the status quo for Iowa.
Okay, nevertheless, how do you explain that?
Yeah. Well, we do think that migration in general slowed a lot across the United States, beginning just a little bit before the Great Recession, and has stayed fairly low since. We're actually, nationally, we're seeing historically low migration from state to state.
That means just people being mobile, moving around.
Right, yes. We're just not moving as much. But one thing that we think with the recession, it put a damper on people's willingness to move. Mm-hmm. As the economy has been improving, people are more willing to take that risk because moving, especially from state to state, involves a lot of risk. Job prospects maybe in other parts of the country are serving as more of an attraction for people to leave Iowa. We may not be having the kind of job growth here that can induce people to move into Iowa. So we might be slipping back into that net loss state.
Mm-hmm. How does it look? I don't know if you look at this. Does the migration look when you see it in terms of urban and rural settlement and migration?
The metropolitan areas in the Midwest especially, are definitely what are drawing people. Rural areas, most of them continue to be losing population.
That's not just Iowa. That's the entire Midwest?
That's across the Midwest. It's a pretty consistent pattern, not just in the last 2 years. It's historically. We call it urbanization, and it's a fact that we can't really do anything about. People tend to be attracted to places that, you know, per square mile have more job opportunity, better recreational and educational opportunities for their kids, where housing values tend to appreciate, just a lot of urban amenities that serve to draw people in, and rural areas usually are the losers on that end.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure connected with this, talk about the age of the people coming and going from the state.
Well, in general, we tend to be a lot more mobile when we're young and when we're single. So our propensity to move decreases as we get older and older. So a lot of the flows that we see from state to state probably are younger people. And so that's concerning for Iowa. If we are in that negative territory, it's likely the younger people that we're seeing leaving but not getting replaced by new people.
Mm-hmm. Also, when you dig down into the numbers, Liesl, what do you see in terms of, since the economic draw is the biggest draw, one of the big factors here, is it the type of jobs that determine who comes and goes?
I think that, yes, the type of job would be important. Since state-to-state moves are motivated a lot of times by people seeking a new job or having a job transfer, one of the areas where we're a little bit worried about Iowa is in the mid-career and higher-level positions, maybe better-paying jobs. So we do tend to do okay with early career jobs. But Iowa's pay levels and the job opportunities as we move up the career ladder maybe aren't as competitive. And so it's harder to attract older movers. They need probably higher compensation, and when we look at Iowa's wage structures and the types of jobs available here, it might not be enough of an inducement to get some of these older mid-career workers, maybe people with families.
When you look at all these factors, what can you say about what can be done to make Iowa more appealing? People here want to stay here, and people from outside want to move to live here.
Well, I think the first thing to do is to set reasonable expectations. You know, we tend to look at the U.S. population and think that out of over 320 million, we ought to be able to attract more of them. But in any given year, actually a pretty low percentage of people move from one state to the next. So we're competing for a much smaller pool than we tend to think. And again, I think it's important to understand the reasons why people move and the characteristics of movers. So again, tend to be younger people, tend to be single. As soon as we start getting some family ties and community ties, we're less likely to move. I think employment is probably, for people who move from state to state, that tends to be the single most important reason. But family ties also, family reasons are another reason for moving. So just understanding what motivates people to move and the characteristics of movers is one thing. Another thing for Iowa, I think we tend to fixate on the people who leave. And so we set a lot of policies trying to retain Iowans or to attract Iowans back, when really where we don't look so good is drawing new people in. So it's not so much that we're losing Iowans. We're not capturing as many people from other states or attracting as many people from other states as we'd like. Illinois tends to be our biggest supplier. So people who were born in Illinois represent about 4% of our population. That's the single biggest contributor as a state. And then another thing, we can't discount the importance of international migration. You know, we tend to look at the competition with other states and really worry about that. But about 5% or a little more of our population was actually born in another country. So that's a very important source of new residents for Iowa.
Okay. Quickly before we go, Liesl, any way to forecast what's to come in the next 2, 3, 5 years?
With Iowa and population growth, the safest bet is to say pretty much what we've seen for the last decade or so. We tend to not have big fluctuations in either direction.
Liesl Ethington, assistant scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University in Ames. Thanks for stepping into our studio, Liesl.
Thank you.
And finally, finishing off this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, let's talk briefly with Sean Moeller, founder of Daytrotter, that innovative music studio he founded in 2006. Sean is now the creator of a new festival, Gas Feed and Seed Festival. That's what it's called, taking place in February, the 16th through the 18th. Sean Moeller, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Ben. Good to talk to you.
A music festival in the dead of winter? Was this your idea?
You know, I'm a glutton for stuff, man.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I like the idea of doing something right after Valentine's Day. Kind of the impetus of it is that hopefully you come out and meet a new band that you're going to fall in love with. So there's love in the air, I guess, for the
okay.
theme of this thing.
Well, help us love along. Who's performing?
Well, you know, I have about 30 artists and comedians performing. Kind of some of the notables are Julian Baker, who just today signed the Matador record. She's just kind of a wonderful folk singer from Tennessee. A lot of people are talking about her this year. She made a lot of year-end lists. There's a band from New York City called Caveman, who kind of, you know, harken back to, you know, awesome a little bit like Wilco, but also kind of arena rock from the 80s. It's pretty amazing stuff. I have the lead singer from Margot and the Nuclear So-and-Sos. He's performing for the first time in almost 4 years. He kind of went through some serious health problems, and so he's coming back for the first time in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I've got Brian Bell from Weezer bringing his band to town. They're flying in just for the show, so I'm pretty excited about that, being a lifelong Blue Album and Pinkerton Weezer fan. It's pretty cool to have one of those guys in town. One of the other kind of notables is this really great hip-hop R&B singer from Chicago called Sir the Baptist. I'm really excited about it. I think he's going to kind of have a really big year, and it's going to be cool to kind of showcase him to everybody.
Sounds like a great lineup. Now, your festival starts with a big feast, as you call it. People coming, artists all sit down together for some kind of Midwestern meal?
Yeah, it's going to be really fun. I just think it's kind of a nice way to kind of kick everything off. You know, this idea of community and dining together. So, yeah, we have this new place in Davenport called Bake. And we're going to have just long tables, and everyone's going to sit together. The festival goers and the artists are going to have kind of a family style meal, you know, something like the Amana colonies would do. Yeah, big bowl of potatoes and a big bowl of whatever. It's going to be we have, you know, a couple of really great chefs, you know, here in the Quad Cities collaborating to come up with this really beautiful meal.
Okay. So now that Day Trotter is done for you, Sean, what's next on the horizon aside from this festival?
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, there's a lot. You know, I've gotten really excited about just kind of pounding on new ideas and thinking about, you know, what more can I contribute, you know, to the state of Iowa and just kind of the music industry in general. So, you know, I'm working on this festival. It's kind of forefront of my thought process right now, but I'm opening up another music venue here in Davenport. Should be open end of February, early March, called the Triple Crown Whiskey Bar and Raccoon Motel. yeah, with a buddy of mine who opened Analog Arcade Bar about a year and a half ago. And, you know, just we're really excited about it. It's going to kind of have it's going to be a very old school sort of vibe to it. I like to think that it's going to be some weird mix between CBGBs and the Ryman Auditorium. So we'll see if we can accomplish that.
All right, Sean Moeller, always a pleasure to talk with you. We're going to go out with some music from one of your featured artists at the new Gas Feed and Seed Festival taking place February 16th through the 18th. Tell us quickly before we do go out, Sean, how do people find out about this new festival?
You know, all the tickets and all the lineup, song links, all that stuff is on the website, MoellerKnife.com.
All right. Sean Moeller, founder of Day Trotter, creator of the new Gas Feed and Seed Festival. Thanks, Sean.
You bet. Thanks a lot, Ben.
All right. Let's go out with this by Caveman, featured at the festival. This is Shut You Down.
I can't even say. We'll be right back.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.